So welcome everybody, and today's session, as I mentioned earlier, is part two on day five of the creation week in Genesis. And I knew I'm missing something. My Bible, it was somewhere. Oh, there it is. Yeah, sorry, just lots of things, Jenny, to try and navigate my way through. So if we could turn in our Bibles to Genesis chapter 1, and that'll just get us ready for where we need to be. And the theme today is called Wonderful Wings. And the more I've looked into this idea of avian flight, avian referring to birds, the more I'm blown away that it is a very powerful context for affirming intelligent design, and more specifically supernatural God design in the world. And when you look at this amazing feather from the peacock, doesn't it just blow us away? People have wondered about the peacock. Another thing I forgot to do this morning was to open this up. Sorry to have to use my teeth in the midst of everybody, but it's just the way it goes sometimes because I forgot to do that. But when you look at the peacock feather, it blows you away, not only in terms of its aesthetic qualities. Look at the design of it. I know Sarah Liddy's keen on her artwork, and there's a few other arty people in this room and have got the arty gene. My mum went to art school, and my dad was an architect, and I grew up with arty things. But I went to the hunting and fishing shop and got these two gorgeous peacock feathers because I was desperate for you to see one live. So that's going to go around this way, and this is going to go around that way. But the feather is not only aesthetically beautiful, but I want you to think about the complexity of creating a feather like that from an egg. And then think about the microstructures that are necessary for each of those things to do what they do. And then the incredible luminosity, the sort of iridescence that comes off from those feathers as you pass them around. As you look at it from different angles, the microstructures in the feather reflect different wavelengths of light at different angles, and it sort of, it glistens, it kind of vibrates. And I reckon that is fascinating. It has challenged the minds of philosophers and rice harvesters and people from all walks of life wherever peacocks are found. Through the millennia, they are absolutely stunning, to say the least. And so the argument again comes down to this: for the invisible things of Him, that is Yahweh or Yahuwah or God, from the creation of the world are clearly seen. They're not obscured. They are clearly seen. That is empirical evidence if you're into research. Empirically visible, able to be quantified and observed, being understood by the things that are made. So His characteristics are manifest in this amazing theme of avian flight this morning. Even His eternal power, and boy, some amazing power is needed to get a peacock feather out of an egg. And His deity or divine nature or Godhead. So let's launch. And I found this lovely photo of an owl about to launch. And I thought that's very fitting for our study on wings this morning. And I just want you to spend a little bit of a moment as we go back to Genesis chapter 1. And read the text again from verse 20 to 21. And I'd like a volunteer to read that for us, please, verses 20 to 21 from Genesis chapter 1. Oh, and can you go all the way through to 23, sorry. So on this day, if peacock feathers weren't enough to occupy God, you imagine he's creating all winged birds after their kind, as well as the whales and the fish, which are in abundance, or dwindling abundance, probably Brian would say, as the Sanford fleet tries to capture them. But nonetheless, the seas are full of the abundance of different creatures. And in this one 24-hour period, the evening and the morning were the fifth day, all these amazing things were made. And I include in that the winged insects and the bats and all those amazing winged creatures that are able to whiz around and enjoy the air. So just for a bit of a taster, what's quite unique and special about the owl is its capacity to fly in fairly low light, often darkness, with incredibly amazing quietness. And they've only recently, as you know, microscopes and things have got better, and you know, they're uncovering the wonders of God's creation. And on the leading feathers of the owls, they have these incredible little microstructures which create little micro turbulences and therefore reduce the actual sound of the owl as it's zooming in on that unsuspecting little mouse. And compared with all other birds, they are absolutely an outstandingly unique bird in terms of its feather and wing design. They've done these incredible wind tunnel tests with high-speed cameras, and they've tracked, you know, what is actually going on with the air turbulences. And it's these little tiny features here on the leading edge of the wing, the feathers, that actually is the key to their silence. A secular science article said this, something along the lines of, they break air into micro turbulences, muffle sound, and they described it as elegant, efficient, and it conserves the bird's energy because there's less turbulence as it swoops in on its prey. Amazing, eh? So, without further ado, we're about to take off, ladies and gentlemen. Would you please put your seatbelt, fasten your belt, and please do not get up, even if you need to go to the bathroom. Only take your seatbelt off when the sign is indicates above your head. We're about to fly our way through avian wing designs. We're going to soar reflectively on the thermals of God's creative wisdom. We're going to dive into scriptures and land with personal applications for our lives. So the first thing that really fascinated me is that you've got an aerofoil design shape in the wing of the birds. And it has what we call the leading edge, and then the sort of the tail structure. And it's got to be curved in this special way and then tapered down to its end at the back in order to create what we call a difference in air pressure. So what happens is, as the air goes up and over the leading edge of the wing, it actually, very in a subtle way, separates the air particles slightly to create a lower air pressure. The air going underneath stays constant in its air pressure because it doesn't have to travel quite so far. So the air going up and over is stretched, less air particles, lower pressure. And pressure always goes from high pressure to low pressure. And so you get this difference which gives uplift. And it's the same concept which is employed in fixed-wing aircrafts today. That very same aerofoil shape has been around in birds for millennia. And if you look at the right-hand side here, we've got the wing shapes of different birds. These are some of the extinct pterosaurs that are fossils of some of these. But when you consider the size of them compared with a small single-engined fixed-wing aircraft, they're amazing. But look at the similarities. And yet, there are differences which place the real birds in the more excellent, more sophisticated category, because these planes are called fixed wing. They can't fold their wings up nicely when they come in to land on the water. There are some on aircraft carriers that have pinched the idea. They can't maneuver their wings depending on the velocity of the air or if they want to swoop in and dive in to get some fish out of the sea. Birds are flexible wing designed creatures, superlative in their design to what mankind has created thus far. So just some of the features. They've got to be light. So the bones in the wing are hollow with these sort of fibrous structures which minimize the weight, the density of the bones. We've talked about flexible wing design, and wow, what an amazing feature that is. Do you know that on these fixed-wing planes, they have little ways of adjusting the, the stick thing, the little... So there are three types of things that can happen. You can have the plane needs to be adjusted for pitch, okay, moving up or down. And at this time, I remembered I was supposed to show you something, because otherwise it doesn't quite work. So I went to the craft shop, got a little biplane. So there's pitch. So, you know, the plane can start to nose dive or can go up. That's pitch. And then there's what they call as roll. Okay, so it can go left to right. And there are ways that they can control that. And then there's what they call yaw, which is shifting, you know, this way. So those three-dimensional issues of movement have had to be designed into fixed-wing aircraft. But the birds have it nailed. Absolutely sorted. Birds can go up and down, nose dive up and down, just incredibly fast. And if you look in your garden this afternoon, as birds whiz around, they don't smack into trees when they're travelling at 50 k's through, and they can come into land on a little branch or a little post, whereas planes take a runway. So we're talking about something that mankind has not even come close to replicating. Now, all this presupposes some very important contextual features being in place. We can take it for granted, but it's called atmosphere. Without atmosphere, birds could flap all they like and they will not fly. Birds will not fly on the moon where there's no atmosphere. So that is why in the Genesis week account of creation, we've already covered how God created the atmosphere with the perfect percentages of different gases and air flows and things like this, and gravity, and the gravitational field that is throughout the earth helps to create this condition so that should a bird take off, it would be able to fly. We mustn't just limit ourselves to, how did birds evolve or get there? You have to have all these other preconditions for winged flight, as recorded in day 5 of Genesis. It also presupposes not only the complexity of a flexible wing, but you've got to have a very efficient respiratory system. And birds, I'm told via Google, have the most sophisticated, efficient respiratory systems out of any living creatures, because their little wings are beating so fast and they've got to be able to suck air in and get it out, in and out, incredibly quickly. And there's a unique system which air flows into the lungs and out. It's like a two-way system, and it's far more efficient than our system. They can process air incredibly efficiently. And it also presupposes all sorts of things like sight. You could imagine a blind bird trying to fly, and a brain, and a circulatory system, because oxygen's not much good if it can't get into the blood and be transported to the cells and provide energy. And of course, all those skeletal systems and nervous systems and other amazing things that we recognize are in birds. How did all that get algorithmically programmed into the DNA of an egg by chance? So I want you to look at this eagle. We'll do it twice. Just look at the fixed wing structure in operation. Tail feathers, flight feathers. See, this is a braking feature, helps to break the bird as it comes in. Notice the feathers are open, allowing the air through to increase its chance of slowing itself down. I've never seen a fixed wing aircraft do this. Now, wings are complex. So we're just looking at wonderful wings today. And I want us to think about those things called feathers. So just want to pass it around. There's no blood and guts, although there is a thrush's wing that landed into the window and was very quickly put aside. In you hand those around. Just take one. So if wings weren't challenging enough in themselves, let us consider the subparts or the structural components that make up an effective, efficient, aerodynamic wing, and that's feathers. And as you choose your feather, these have been gathered over several months with Holly and I on our adventures to the coastal regions around Tauranga. And there are many different types of feathers. Now, one feather would be complex enough to try to design, but all of these different types of feathers is mind-boggling. There's not only a curve in the feature of the feather in one direction, but it actually bends in two directions as well. And one half of the flight feather, primary flight feathers, if you've got a primary flight feather, is not an exact symmetrical copy of the other on the other side. You'll see one side of your feather is shorter and the other side is longer, and that creates that aerofoil shape. So the wind passes over the front leading edge and then runs down the back of the tail part of the feather. If you look at your, are there any left over? Could we have them up back up the front, because I need to have one. I forgot to grab one. Now, the beauty of these feathers is that down the bottom we have what's called the quill, and you'll see it's hollow. And if you look closely, and for a couple of the young scientists here, I brought one of these along so that you could check it out. You'll see it's not only hollow, but it's got little structural supports in the quill to help it make it more rigid. But you'll notice it's very smooth, because this is the bit that joins into the ligaments of the bird's wing. And birds' molt, and they have to be able to come out as well as stay in with incredible strength. Now, feel how light your feather is. It's a beautiful, lightweight, aerodynamic structure. Now, as you go up the feather, we call this part the rachis. And if you turn it over, you'll see it's got a little channel down the center. So it's actually got two features to the upper part of it, which actually give it more strength, more elasticity under pressure to move left or right and up and down and so on. And it's from the rachis that the barbs, these are the bits coming out to the side, come off. And unless you're one of the young scientists with the little magnifying glass, it's very unlikely you'll see the other microstructures, which I will refer to later. But we've got the quill, the rachis, and the barbs are the things coming off to the side. But just try this. As you move the feather, you'll see how it catches the wind. Yeah, you can fan yourself if you get too hot. They're genius for developing thrust. And yet, notice the difference, if you can, as you go up and down. It really catches the air on the downward stroke, but it's relatively straightforward, less resistance on the upstroke. And what happens is that the birds, when they do their downstroke, the feathers are very close like this. So they capture the air going down, but the air is able to actually go through the feathers on the reverse stroke, you see. Whereas on a fixed wing aircraft, there's no air being able to go through the wing at all. So the bird is designed to maximize the downstroke to give it upward thrust, uplift, and for that matter, thrust, which is forward propulsion. But when they lift their wings the opposite way, upward, air is able to go through the gaps in the feathers. It is genius. Now, I'm going to pass around the little thrush wing. There were two, but one mysteriously disappeared and one of the cats had a cheeky look on its mush. But when you have a look at it, and I do encourage you to look at it, I want you to look for the primary feathers, which are the lower, bigger ones, the secondary feathers, and then the tertiary feathers, and just see how gloriously made it is. It won't bite. Now, the other features about feathers is that feathers are waterproof, so they resist water. Very, very smooth, obviously, for aerodynamic features. But they also provide insulation. And some of you may have chosen one of the fluffy down feathers. And these keep the little old bird nice and cozy. And there are tail feathers, contour feathers, primary, secondary, tertiary feathers. It's stunning. And how do all those hundreds of feathers get algorithmically programmed into the DNA within an egg? So here's a underside view of a coastal seagull bird type creature. And you can see the primary feathers, the secondaries and the tertiary feathers. You can see the fluffy downy feathers and the tail feathers all there. Now, with your feather, I want you to take it now and peel some of those barbs away and create a little split. Create a split in the barbs. So if you've got it nice and smooth, just break it. Now you'll notice there's a bit of resistance when you break it. That's because there are little microstructures called barbules and barbicels that are actually hooking one of those barbs to another barb. Now, then I want you to take your hand and your fingers and just preen it. And you'll see that like Velcro, it'll repair itself and join together again. Now, some of your feathers may not be quite so good at doing that because you're lacking. What the birds have is an oil gland at the base of their bodies, and they get their little beaks and they rub their beak on the oil gland, and they actually rub oil onto their feathers, and they make the preening far quicker and more efficient. So what we've got here is a repairable feather, not only an aerodynamic feather that's brilliant for flying, but if it got split, the bird can just go, shh, shh. Now you try that on your flat tire next week. The other amazing thing is that they are not only repairable, but they are replaceable. Because most birds molt at least twice a year. And it's because they molt that I was able to find all these amazing feathers. Now, when was the last time a tire on your car replaced itself by itself? The incredible thing is that this molting process has to take place in harmony between the two wings. If all of one wing molted and the other didn't, it would be chaos. The bird wouldn't take off and be munched by a snake. So the molting process has to be programmed in to be symmetrical, one wing with the other wing, and off it goes. I find this absolutely stunning evidence of God's wisdom and creative power. The other fun thing is that if that wasn't enough, feathers have an aesthetic quality. They have, as I mentioned with the peacock feathers, different colours, different patterns. Not necessarily showy like the peacock, but they can actually provide camouflage. Camouflage so that they blend with their environment and are not easy to be seen. And you think of the challenge of an egg having to create feathers that just in a certain place, just at a certain length along the barb, the colour has to change. And they're just a little bit long further on, it has to change to a different colour and then finish with another colour as well. Although these aren't colours, as you arties would know, they're neutrals, black and white, grey. So they're not part of the colour spectrum. Wow, I don't know about you, but I think this is an amazing thing. And all of this involves mathematical three-dimensional symmetry. Wow. You try designing that on a program, Brett, on your computer next week, just for fun. Yeah. And a 3D printer, you think of the technology that's gone into that. I'm picking up. All right. So there's a couple of verses here which I found very interesting in this theme. First of all, we've got in Psalm 57 and verse 1. If you might like to look that up or just read it. Would somebody like to read that from the slide, please?
Yes, in the shadow of your wings will I make my refuge until these calamities be overpast.
Thanks, Sarah. This is metaphorical language of God. God's capacity to provide compassionate care when under pressure and trials and tribulations. Under the shadow of the mother bird's wings. There's another one which relates to a historical story of Ruth. Would someone like to read that one from Ruth chapter 2 verse 12? And you remember that Naomi and Ruth had met one another because of the marriage of Ruth to Naomi's son, and they'd passed away, and she cleaves to Naomi and wants her God to be her own God and her people to be the same people, and desires to journey with them back to Israel. And it's an amazing statement. Under whose wings you've come to trust. Have you come to trust in Yahweh in that way? Can you confidently say that under whose wings you've come to trust? Perhaps you have. Have you wandered, as it were, from those sheltering wings, those compassionate, caring wings of Yahweh? And is he calling you back today to the shelter and the intimacy of that care and protection of, metaphorically speaking, his wings? Well, I mentioned before that there are these microstructures found in feathers. And I thought this was a glorious example of feathers from a pheasant, a male pheasant. And some of you may have seen these pheasants in the wild. I was desperately looking for one on the side of the road going to Te Araha a couple of weeks ago to the Wairangamai Valley for a walk, a bush walk, an old historic gold mining town. But I did see one, but to stop and try and pick it up, I would have risked being killed probably by the traffic. So I left it. But when you look at this pheasant, you have to go, wow. I mean, I do. I think that is stunning. If Sarah Lilly was trying to paint it, you'd have to get a pretty good range of colours there and play around with the tints and tones and the yellows and the reds and to get the oranges and the brownie colours. And what an amazing bit of artwork. Well, let's look now at these microstructures that I mentioned that we can't see when we hold our feather up close. First of all, there's the rachis, and here are the barbs going off, which you can see on your feather. But if we get a microscope and go a bit deeper, we find that each of the barbs, these are the barbs coming down here, these long lines, have little corresponding tangential barbules coming off the side. Now that in itself is quite phenomenal if you think of how many of these barbules there are on just one feather. You can see how many barbs there are, but imagine how many barbules, the little bits here, are required just for one feather. But it goes deeper. There is another microstructure at the end of these barbules, and this is what they look like. They're called barber cells. And these little barber cells, or hooks, can you see those little hooky structures? See that little hook there? They are the thing which, like Velcro, keep the sides of the feather together. They hook in. But, like Velcro, they can be pulled apart safely and then preened and repaired, and there's no damage. I find that stunning. We're talking small. I mean, if you're into micrometers, that's a millionth of a meter, or a thousandth of a millimeter, that's small. Now, this is what I found on a creation article about this. And I'd love a volunteer to read that for us, please. Starting from each hook. Just saves my voice, because I killed my voice off singing that song the wrong key.
Each hook is actually a moving joint. At the base of the hook is a hinge that helps the hook latch the well through the feathers.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Chris. I do appreciate your support. To me, it just cries out, design, 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 intelligence, intelligence. You see, as my brother pointed out, who goes out in evangelism in Auckland each week, he said one of the things he's been sharing with people is that basically if you narrow everything down to the universe, it's made up of three things. There's matter, there's energy, and then there's information. Now what's fascinating is that matter cannot make information on itself. Neither can energy create information on itself. The only way information can be made is through intelligence. Just think about that. The only way information can be made is through intelligence. And it's an incredibly compelling argument that natural processes of just matter and energy, time, randomness, cannot produce information which is so incredibly sophisticated and so incredibly compacted down into the DNA that it just cries out supernatural origins. Well, let's move on. If that hasn't wowed you, I really wanted to wow us with God's creative wisdom and power in the hummingbird. These little creatures are amazing. There's around about 300 species, and they weigh only 3 grams on average. That's about 1.5 or roughly centimeters long. And they can't walk, interestingly enough. They're great at perching, but they're no good at walking. But this statistic really freaked me out. There's about 1,000 to 1,500 feathers on these little hummingbirds. And you can see how tiny they are. Depending on the type of hummingbird species, they can flap their wings. Now try and get a hold of this. We're not talking 5 times a second. We're talking up to 50 to 200 wing beats per second. That's where they get the humming name from, because their little wings are going, and it sounds like a hum. And I've seen them at the zoological park in Singapore, in the big bird park, I think it was called. And they're amazing. Pretty small though. What also is incredible is that they have these microstructures in the layers of the keratin and these other structures of the feather that reflect light, wavelengths of light, different wavelengths of light, depending on the angle that you look at the feather. So that as the bird turns, you'll see the red will shift from this side to that side, and all the colours are like moving, because there's this amazing iridescence built into the hummingbird's feathers. So this is what a little hummingbird looks like in slower motion. And until they had these amazing cameras where you could slow down movement, you know, we might have just thought, oh, they just go like this, you know, really, really fast. But actually, each stroke is very ingeniously involves changes in the shape of the wing. So the wing is slightly drawn in. The angle at which the upstroke is shaped is different from the shape of the downstroke, and the wing has this capacity to sort of rotate in this amazing loopy sort of direction as it goes about its hovering. And it's very rare for birds to be able to hover. Birds like hummingbirds can not only stay stationary, but they can actually move backwards, sideways, and up and down and off. It's taken a long time for mankind to develop the capacity to fly. What was the name of the American chaps who developed the first fixed-wing aircraft with enough motor power to actually get it to fly for about 100 metres? The Wright brothers. Does anyone know roughly when that was achieved? I think it was around about, and don't quote me on the audio recording button because I've got a slide on it, but I think it was about 1914 or something like that. Around about 1914 or somewhere around there, the Wright brothers were experimenting. They finally got this engine and the shape of the wings, and that's one of the reasons why I bought this little twin little biplane in, because it looked not really like this, but it looked a little bit like this, and they had a motor at the front. And they managed to get this plane to move for about 100 and something meters, and it was, wow, look what we've done. And that was about 100 years ago. Now, birds have been flying for thousands of years and doing it much better. It took incredible intelligence for those guys to develop, those Bright brothers to develop the first plane. And in the last 100 years, mankind has developed all sorts of planes and now little drones and things like this. But not one of those planes was developed by chance, by energy and matter accidentally coalescing together. Each of these planes that mankind has made required information, and information came from intelligence. Well, I need a volunteer. So, there's three potential volunteers, Lucia, Bianca, or Sarah Lily. I want you to come up here and do a test flight to see if we can get this thing airborne. Any volunteers? I can bring it over to you and you can stand and fly it from your seat if you like.
Yeah.
How about that? And just throw it towards Aruna, but not at her head. Put your hands up, Aruna, just in case it hits you. Ooh. Okay. Now, we got a bit of a little glitch there. So I had to buy this from a shop, and in the shop it came in a packet with information, instructions on how to assemble it. These wings have been carefully cut out and packaged. There's a little weight at the front, and there's the capacity to adjust the wings so that you can actually fine-tune it slightly. There's little lines here to show you where to clip the plastic structural supports on, and you can play around with it a bit to sort of see if it'll fly a little bit better, and then off it goes. My point being is that this little plane did not appear in the plastic bag by chance. It required a designer and information. It requires information about aerodynamics, about uplift and thrust. The thrust is provided by the hand, and off it goes. The shape of the wings helps to create, you know, that uplift, and the weight at the front helps to sort of create a center of balance that enables it to move. The point is, it suffers damage, doesn't it? Look at this, it's already a bit out of shape. You think of what birds do every day as they whiz through the skies. They do their thing, like the hummingbird. They are superior.
And that's what happens to the ones who believe in the Big Bang.
Now, I mentioned that the hummingbird has these incredible microstructures, and they've analysed these different keratin layers, and they reflect different light waves from the light spectrum at different angles, and that's how you get the purple or the blue or the, you know, the sort of aqua colour. It's amazing stuff. If the hummingbird wasn't amazing enough, God has put into it these incredible iridescent features just to blow us away.
It says there also that they can't walk.
No, they don't. They can perch, and it's just they are so designed to be on the move as little hummingbirds. Yeah.
Could they jump?
Yeah.
You mean from branch to branch?
Well, they fly. They're only about as long as your half of a finger. And they just don't have that walking ability like a pheasant. Or yes, it hovers. Correct. And it hovers, if we just go back, and it has this incredible tongue which goes up around its skull, and it comes out and it splits, and it has these little curly features on it, goes into the nectar, the curly features come around. It doesn't actually go like that. The curly features capture the nectar, and then it withdraws its tongue. It's a more superior collection device than going like a straw. They originally thought it was like a straw, poke your tongue in, but it's actually incredibly more sophisticated. But that's another story. I'm just going to focus on the wings.
Really struggle to land on chakra.
Yeah.
But they're great at song.
And there's incredible mathematics involved in calculating their momentum and to get it just right so that they stop within a matter of a centimetre or two. Sure, some of the birds on the ponds, you'll see them, they come into land, they go along the surface of the water. But let's move on. The godwit. The godwit Māori name is kuaka. And the kuaka is very special as a bird in terms of flight because it flies the furthest of any migratory bird. They can fly up to 12,000 kilometres in one flight. There are no long-haul passenger planes that can replicate that. They have to have petrol, fuel stops, change captains and navigators, and you know they have all the sophisticated gear on board in order to fly those big planes. These little birds molt and grow lovely fresh new feathers before their big migration takes off, and they zoom off. They double their weight. They know how to maximize mathematically the amount of food and energy they'll need. They gobble up lots of food, they grow new feathers, and shkapom, off they go. And this is where they head. They go between New Zealand all the way up here through Australia, Japan, up through the Russian sort of territories, and up into the Arctic and Alaska areas. And then later they'll come all the way down the North and South Pacific back to New Zealand. And they don't need a pit stop on a big international runway. How do they do it?
Formation.
They do use the V formation, and there's been fascinating studies, Annabelle, as to why birds fly in V formation. Earlier views thought that birds just by chance, you know, get alongside like these. You're all in rows, you see. The gap's sort of the same, and you think, oh, it's just by chance, you know. But they've now studied that there are these little turbulences that are created as each bird is doing its wing thing. And these turbulences, they create actually an uplift only within a certain distance from the bird that's leading the way. And so the birds actually position themselves perfectly for these turbulences to benefit from the uplift support that their buddies give them. And then they rotate around and they save on energy. And it's good camaraderie.
We do it running in America.
Yeah. Tour de France. Mm-hmm. Drafting.
Yeah. So there's some fascinating things about migratory birds in the scriptures. The storks flying across the Middle East, Palestine. And the sad thing is that the prophet used that analogy of the migratory storks and said, the storks know their time. When they need to, the seasons are changing, they can read the seasons, they know when to move, they know when to get cracking. But the prophet said, my people do not know the times. And the exhortation to us is that we are in these last times. We are in a world that is ever more, even more than before, desperately crying out for truth, for answers, for understanding, and we need to realize the times that we're in and to seize this season to be about the Master's work and not to fall into the trap that Israel suffered of old. You can read that in Jeremiah chapter 8 and verse 7. So, pretty stunning stuff. The theme for today was wonderful wings. And I had this little recurring theme of who wrote the algorithm into the little egg. And so I have another opportunity for another young scientist to do another little experiment. this is nothing to do with it. I just thought I'd bring along an amazing nest, but that's another topic, intelligent design of nest construction. But I have the need for a volunteer, and I've got an egg. Now, this is not hard-boiled, so it's serious stuff. Now, the whole argument is who wrote the incredible, complex algorithms within the DNA of a bird's egg so that when it cracks through the little shell and goes jeep, 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 it knows how to grow not only wings, but all those feathers, primaries, secondaries, tertiaries, contours, tail feathers, downy feathers, you name it, feathers, iridescent feathers, waterproofing, insulation features, all of those barbs and barbules and barbicils and the camouflage and the iridescence and the beautiful colour. Who wrote the algorithm into the DNA of the egg? Yeah, it's. I think it's probably a combo of observing mum and dad flying and being pushed out of the nest. And yeah, yeah, they've got the built-in capacity. Did you know that eggs breathe? They allow oxygen to go in and that carbon dioxide to go out, and the albumin that is around the yolk acts as an amazing protection, like a shock absorber for the yolk, so that the yolk and the little fertilized thing there can actually cope with the bumps and the jiggles and the things in the nest or the sway of the branches. But this egg, though it's not a fertile one, it won't do it. But you imagine, hummingbirds' eggs are the size of my fingernail. Who wrote the DNA algorithms into the egg so that when you go shkapom, it comes out? So who'd like to come and break this? Any good at breaking
before
eggs?
Before you do that, do you know how to tell an egg that's hard or an egg that's
rotten? Sarah Lilly, are you any good at cracking eggs? Do you want to?
I cracked
it
by my neighbor's
doorstep. Bianca? Okay. Would one of the other folk like to have a go? Jason, would you like to do that?
Jason.
He's good on the shofar. Now, but you have to come up here so we can all see it, you see. And I'm just going to put this underneath. Okay. So here we go. Whoa. Amazing. Thank you. Thank you very much. So here it is. It's coming around. And I want you to actually look at this egg.
I think we women have done that many times.
And think, and think at an incredible microscopic level.
I didn't mean to put that yolk in the white today.
There is DNA information built in so that that egg can develop. They talk about they've mapped the genome of a chicken, and there's approximately 1 billion base pairs and approximately 20,000 to 23,000 genes organized into 39 chromosome pairs. It is a mathematical, superlatively complex system. So I'm going to wrap it up now with this question to us all, a question. Which came first? Which came first, the chicken or the bird or the egg? Which came first? How did? Where does a bird come from? Very good, Anna. Well, look, I actually don't believe either the bird or the egg came first. My response is God came first. And so it's a good question to ask people. Which, well, what I mean is that God pre-existed first.
But the word came implies that he's up.
Yes. Thank you, Chris. But the point, folks, to take with you away is this argument. what came first, or who came first, the egg or the bird? And I believe, rationally, you can't have an egg coming first, because how on earth would that work? You can't have a bird coming first, because birds come from, well, where? And so a logical, rational answer is God. And so I come back to that statement at the beginning, that the invisible things of God are clearly seen by the things that are made. And so, as it says in the scriptures, those who, I'm just going to squiz to here, wait upon Yahweh will renew their strength, and they shall not grow faint and weary, but they will be able to rise up with renewed strength as with the wings of eagles and overcome. And in Isaiah's day, Israel was facing some terrible stuff. But the exhortation to us is to spend quality time. That's what resting, those who wait upon and rest and spend quality time with God. God is crying out for relationship with his people. He wants us to draw near to him, to spend not action, not frantic activity so much, as time with him under the shadow of his wings, and get to know him. And as we spend that time in prayer and fasting, or just reflecting, praise, meditation, just waiting on him, we will renew our strength for his service and for his glory.